Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, and welcome back to another edition of Real Science Radio. And I have with me a special guest, Ryan Williams, who's filling in with Doug. And when Ryan's here, we go through Creation Magazine, and we've got some really good stories from a new blood type, suicide insects, giant vegetables, and more on dinosaur soft tissue and Neanderthals. So welcome back to the studio, Ryan.
Good to be back. Also, speaking of Neanderthals, it's great to be in studio with one. So,
okay. All right. I guess I resemble that remark. So, okay. Anyways, for people who don't know, Ryan's my son, and he's a firmware engineer at Micron Corporation. So how's things going at Micron? Going good?
Going good, yeah.
All right. So, Ryan, let's dive right in. There's a story in the Creation Magazine on the cockatoo. And I know you mentioned pre-show that you really liked that one. So what's that all about?
I think it's just kind of cool. It's kind of funny where you got these cockatoos in parks, and they've learned how to use drinking fountains. Yeah, they use their feet and their body weight to be able to kind of twist the thing that's on there and get it to drink water. And what's interesting is they'll actually use it pretty frequently. They use it probably about half the time. Instead of just going to the ponds or wherever nearby to drink water, they use drinking fountains because it's better water than the pond water. And what seems like what happens too is they'll do it, and then other ones will see them doing it, and they'll realize what they're doing, and they're like, oh, that's a neat way to get water. Let's go do that.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, birds have always shown to be really intelligent, and you know, they've got these really big brains, right?
Bird brain! Yeah. Bird brain is kind of a myth, though.
Yeah,
exactly. Because they can be pretty smart, and it kind of challenges the idea of, you know, that's, some of these are smarter than some kinds of chimps, but chimps are, you know, supposed to be the closest thing to us, and monkeys are like really, really smart. But you got birds that are doing things that are pretty smart too. So where does that come from? Why are some birds smarter than some monkeys, which are supposed to be the, you know, peak animal, you know, underneath us?
Yeah, I think they're smarter than a lot of politicians, but that's another show. We'll leave that one for Doug's weekly worldview show that he does on the radio. So Ryan, one that really stuck out for me is there's more on the Archaeopteryx. So for decades, evolutionists have been promoting this as a missing link between dinosaurs and birds. And so they recently analyzed one of these Archaeopteryx specimens in the Chicago Museum. And what they revealed was pretty extraordinary, that they had full feathers, and the feathers that fill the aerodynamic gap between the body and the wing. And so this is huge, because evolutionists always argue that Archaeopteryx had a long upper arm bone, creating a flight gap. And so they insisted this would make flight impossible. And they so badly want this to be in between a dinosaur evolving into a bird. I mean, it's so silly, you know, what the lengths that they go to. And I did want to quote really quick Alan Fiducia. You know, we've quoted him many times. Creationists quote him because he's an evolutionist, and he's also a bird expert. And he's long said that all Archaeopteryx ever was and ever will be is a bird, a perching bird. And I remember he made some comment about, we're not going to be buying into any of this paleo babble about this thing being a dinosaur turning into a bird. So not a really good, you know, it's another missing link. They always claim, hey, we finally found the missing link. Oh, so you're admitting that they were all missing links before, but you said you had found them. Well, this is another example of a missing link that's, you know, gone the way of the dodo bird. But wait a minute, the dodo bird, actually, didn't they discover one?
I thought that they had, created one, like they cloned one or something somehow. Like they genetically engineered one.
Yeah.
But so
maybe that's...
So maybe the Archaeopteryx will come like the way of the dodo bird. And,
yeah,
you know, they'll recycle it in 10 years, hoping people forgot that it really wasn't a missing link.
Yep. So, Ryan, what's the next story? And I'm looking up right now the dodo bird. Just to clarify, you know, we want to be always factually correct on Real Science Radio.
Yeah, so next up, we've got giant vegetables, as was teased in the opening. And this one's kind of interesting because, yeah, every fall you see the photos of, you got these big pumpkins and giant zucchinis and, you know, all sorts of stuff. Then these things are like huge. And evolutionists will say, they're like, oh, this must mean evolution works, because you've got these giant vegetables that now they're they're enhanced. They're better than they were before. But really, these giant vegetables isn't really evolution. It's just a inhibitor gene of some sort being a mutation happening in the inhibitor gene so it can just grow without control. So growing without control isn't really evolution. Nothing's changing. There's no new information. Now it just continues to grow without stopping at all ever and ends up being more probably of a nuisance than really a actual beneficial thing. You don't see people, you know, you don't see farmers really trying to make this happen so they can get giant pumpkins and zucchinis because they kind of want them to be the size they are. A lot of times they genetically engineer this stuff to be smaller so they don't take up too much space and resources. So I wouldn't really call it a gain from evolution. It's just mutation of gene that stops it from growing.
Well, one advantage it did occur to me, though, is we were just in Pennsylvania, you know, in October, you know, before Halloween. And, you know, they're good. They'd be good for a pumpkin carving contest, you know.
They would be good for a pumpkin carving contest.
So these huge pumpkins. But anyway, so.
It'd be kind of cool to have a Cinderella pumpkin cart, you know, with that's a real pumpkin, too, you know.
Exactly. So, you know, one of the things this article talks about is that it's a loss of information that all of a sudden causes some of these vegetables to get really big. But when I read this, I thought, okay, that very likely could be the case. But on the other hand, Ryan, it reminded me that we've done shows in the past of really big things in the fossil record, you know, before the flood. Remember that show? I think you did it with me on the dragonfly with the
man
and some of these huge centipede creatures of the past. It reminded me of that King Kong movie where those things were really huge, you know, pretty freaky. So anyway, things can get really big. And so I did a really quick search before this show. And so maybe we think there were plants that were probably bigger and maybe more lush, more, even more nutritious before the flood. And maybe that's why man was delegated to be able to eat meat after the flood. And for example, there's this fossil plant, and I want to challenge you to say this three times really fast. It's Lepidodendron, I believe is how you pronounce that. Lepidodendron.
As a Lepidodendron expert, I think you said it right.
Okay. Okay. And so the fossil size of this thing that they find in the fossil record is 100 to 130 foot tall. The modern size is just a few feet. And there's the calamites, its horsetail, the modern relative, and its fossil size is 30 to 60 feet. But modern size is only 3 to 8 feet, and there's so many other examples we could give. And, you know, Dr. Carl Baugh and Dr. Joseph D'Elia and others, they've done studies with, you know, increasing atmospheric pressures, increased oxygen, et cetera. And by the result of this, you can get tomato plants that grow 15 to 30% faster. Sweet potato vines grew several times longer. I could go on and on. And basically, you would have had things that were bigger before the flood. We know that from the fossil record. So, you know, maybe some of these things that were growing bigger before the flood were actually very useful, and it wasn't a loss of information. It was maybe a different manifestation of the information that made these things larger in combination with the atmospheric conditions that would have been better. There would have been higher oxygen content, for example. So anyways, and Genesis, remember, it describes longer lifespans for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And we always had trouble, you know, I think many Christians always had trouble understanding these longer lifespans. But if the conditions are right and you don't have this thing in the DNA on the telomeres winding down, humans could very feasibly live, you know, 800, 900 years. And even evolutionists admit, the genetics does support the possibility. So anyways, Ryan, so what's the next story we got?
Yeah, so next up, there's hemoglobin has been found in dinosaur bones again. And it almost feels like beating a dead horse at this point because we find it more and more, all these tissues and dinosaur bones that shouldn't be there. But it's worth being the dead horse because it's super important because these molecules like hemoglobin break down really, really fast. And even generous estimates give it thousands, not millions of years before decay. And this is just yet another dinosaur that has hemoglobin found in its bones. And then every time this happens, every time DNA or soft tissue, hemoglobin is found, evolutionists always pull out a new, preservation theory. How could this be preserved? They like to use iron for a while, then they change to salt, then clay, and then it seems like lately the newest one is just magic.
Yeah.
They're just kind of... The dinosaur had supernatural powers because they'd rather the dinosaur be God than God. So it just manages to keep that soft tissue forever. But the scripture says death entered with Adam, and the flood was only probably, you know, like 4,000 years ago. And that's still within the time frame that stuff can still be found. And that makes a lot more sense than millions of years and failed theory after failed theory to try to explain it.
Yeah, so evolutionists have always used dinosaurs as a huge weapon for themselves, like, starting with kids. I mean, Dr. Seuss books talking about dinosaurs being millions and millions of years old. I believe dinosaurs were millions of years old up until at least age 30. And I just thought, you know, at that time I was a Christian, but I was like, well, God used them as pets. You know, they were the big pets he played with for millions of years before humans came along. Well, that never fit. It never fit either the Bible or science. And that's the key to what we're talking about here is everybody loves to talk about dinosaurs, both kids and adults. And dinosaurs are not millions of years old. This is powerful evidence. And the evidence just keeps piling in. Bob Inyart started a list long ago on all the soft tissue discoveries in dinosaurs. It's a very exhaustive list. And it's a list from secular science journals. This isn't just Real Science Radio telling you about this. This is Harvard and Yale. They're all on board with the discovery of these soft tissues, and now hemoglobin, a very fragile molecule. So Ryan, it just keeps the evidence just keeps pouring in. So, yep. All right. So the next one, I kind of like this one, Ryan. It's Ice Age pyrotechnology. And it turns out Neanderthals were engineers. You know, I'm a retired engineer now. I retired from Micron. You called me a Neanderthal. I'm glad because
Neanderthal was and are engineers.
That's right. You know, Neanderthals also retired, I'm sure. So what happened was, so archaeologists, they uncovered Ice Age hearths in Ukraine that reached over 600 degrees Celsius. So that's more than 1100 degrees Fahrenheit. So Ryan, they had the technology to make really hot fires. And these fires, they didn't just burn wood. So these engineered fires had structured hearths, optimized airflow, multiple heating strategies, and consistent temperature control. Because there's a lot you can do when you can get temperatures really high, certain things you want to, you know, try to produce. Maybe you want to purify some metal or something. So there's all kinds of, you know, very good reasons, you know, to have this technology. So pretty cool.
So, and maybe there's not much evidence for it. Maybe they use the fire and the intense heat to blacksmith. It is a really important thing for making weapons. Similar
Absolutely.
To our sponsor, foamknight.com, foam-knight.com. They make foam swords and foam weapons for kids' birthday parties, probably a little bit safer than the blacksmith potential, you know, swords of the Neanderthals. But these ones are not made by Neanderthals, very high quality, very great for kids' parties, very safe too. And that kind of stuff can be a lot of fun. If you've got a family disagreement, good way to hash it out and figure it out. You know, I would have liked to use on him as a kid. Be a great, like, I wish foamknight.com existed when I was a kid.
Yeah, so that's foam-knight.com, and that's K-N-I-G-H-T, not N-I-G-H-T. So Knight, foam-knight.com.
And they've got swords, axes, shields, so a whole bunch of stuff for a lot of fun for kids and adults alike.
Yeah. So we highly encourage you to get these. This is a Christian-owned business, and it supports shows like ours. And what a great Christmas gift. And this isn't just for kids. I mean, it's more ideal probably for if you've got younger kids or you even teenagers and you want to have these fun little sword fights. We encourage you to the great Christmas gift for under the tree.
I remember the other day I was at your house and there's one of those wrapping paper tubes, and I grabbed it. Then I, you know, kind of hit my mom with it, and she's like, "I was just waiting. I was waiting for you to do that." So good for all ages.
It is good for all ages, and these are, you know, they're safer than probably that thing. Actually, the poly thing probably hurts. So, so speaking of Neanderthals, there's also this bone processing factory. And so, Ryan, archaeologists recently discovered something astonishing, a Neanderthal bone processing workshop. So what do you, did you get a chance to check this story out? I know you're kind of into this whole eating fat and some kind of weird thing you were telling me about a while back. So,
well, I could go into that if you want, but really the point of this one, the point of this one is that, because we know now that eating, you know, completely lean meat ends up being bad because, you know, too much protein, just like too much of anything, can end up being a problem for the body. So a lot of times, you know, like the store-bought meat is like 80% lean, 20% fat, or, you know, whatever the percentage is, depending on what you want. But this is really interesting because it seems like Neanderthals knew that too, or figured it out, because they would have they found these big bone processing factories, as they call them, where they were just grinding down bones to make a bone broth that they would use for their meals, as if they kind of knew that, hey, we need to have something to offset all this lean meat so our bodies don't reject the protein, which is really impressive for people who are deemed to be, you know, subhuman and more of a common ancestor than actual human. I mean, this is a lot smarter, similar to the pyrotechnics than any sort of, you know, subhuman is. Humans had to learn this kind of over again during like the Middle Ages, I think it was, where they had these diseases that were happening because the body couldn't process all lean meat they were eating. Yeah. So it's something that even modern humans have, quote unquote, modern humans have struggled with. And the Neanderthals figured it out and figured out the solution to it too, as well. Not just knowing it's a problem, but being like, hey, if we kind of make a bone broth, this will really help offset this, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, we've done shows in the past on the genius of ancient man. I think we need to maybe do another one of those shows coming up. So it occurred to me, Ryan, if anybody's listening to the show and you're a manager at Applebee's or Chili's, bone broth, that could be a good item to add to the menu. What do you think?
Well, I'm sure they have some soups, which is probably, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe
bone broth, that's interesting. And so, Ryan, this next story I wanted to get to is a new human blood type, Guada negative. And so this was discovered in Guadalupe, and it's the result of a mutation. And so it's a whole nother new blood type, but I guess this one would be extremely rare, like down to one individual perhaps. So what's the deal with this blood type? Is this a good thing? Is this genetic variability?
So it sounds like it came from what they describe it. It sounds like it came from a mutation. But the thing is, it doesn't sound like a good thing, because it sounds like yet another harmful mutation, because the way I look at it is this person's, because they say this blood type is incompatible with other blood types. That's why it's a new blood type. So this person's, if they were to get injured, they're not going to be able to get a blood transfusion, because anybody else's in the entire world's blood type won't work. They're not going to be able to give somebody a blood transfusion, because it won't work. So it kind of made the blood useless. So it's yet another example of a mutation that is harmful in doesn't help anything, and in fact hurts things. And evolution has to rely on these small mutations over time. But the problem is with all the harmful ones, like this one, for example, it's not going to be a good thing. Having a new blood type isn't really advancing. It actually is going to be harmful, and definitely in the wild would not be something helpful.
Yeah.
If this person gets injured, it's going to be a lot harder for them to be saved by a blood transfusion now.
Exactly. And so, yeah, mutations are all, you know, the vast majority of mutations are harmful. There's some that are, you know, maybe neutral. Some mutations we believe are non-random mutations, and they're really part of the design. And that's a whole nother story. But the way things like jumping genes and things like that, it's amazing what the DNA can do. But some of these that are random, that aren't part of God's design, they cause a degradation to the genome and make it worse for people. And yet evolution thinks that it can advance by some tiny steps, mutations and selection over time. It's just a really silly idea.
Mm-hmm. Same thing with sickle cell. They said, oh, sickle cell's it's a good mutation. Well, yeah, it's nice in certain areas because then you're not as susceptible to malaria, but there's also just other health issues that come by having sickle cell. Yeah. So it's not a universal good thing just because you're less likely to get malaria, because the mosquitoes don't want your blood. They're not interested in it.
It's a very pseudo good, quote, good thing. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, what you do is what would you rather have? The sickle cell trait that has all the harmful effects that you mentioned. In fact, Ryan, we were at a NFL football game where a Pittsburgh Steelers receiver couldn't.
It was their safety. It's Ryan Clark.
Yeah, he couldn't play because he was in Denver and he had that mutation.
He was never able to play in Denver his entire career because the altitude.
Yeah. And so if you've got this, what would you rather have, this mutation or not have it and be in it? And then if you're in a malaria area, just move. Get a van, get your friends, pack up and move. That's what I'd rather do instead of living somewhere and be happy that you got this disease. And so evolutionists will say that that's evolution. I've had a PhD scientist tell me that cancer is evolution. I mean, it's silly, the things they come up with. So, and you know, one of the arguments that evolutionists always love to use, and I want to get into this one, it's human and chimp DNA similarity. And the article is the human-chimp DNA similarity myth collapses. And so forever, we've heard about how chimps and humans are 98 to 99% similar. Ryan, when our family was in Washington, D.C., we went to the Smithsonian and they had this big display about humans and chimps and how we're 98% similar. And so we must have a common ancestor. Well, all of that was never true. And when you actually do the sequencing, and Jonathan Sarfati wrote this article, and he did a great job, is, you know, more and more studies, as we study and we have more and more access to actual genetic data, it comes out to about 85%. And so that
15% is huge.
Yeah, it's huge. And even back when it was like, say, 97, 98%, even that was too much mathematically. Because back then, using those really favorable numbers for evolutionists, you'd still have to have at least 40, each breeding couple would have to have 40 offspring just to break even and not de-evolve their species because of all the harmful mutations. With 15% difference, I know we've had Sal Cordova on, that means you'd have to have like 30, I can't remember the exact numbers, like 55,000 offspring in order to have a chance to maybe evolve something without, you know, degrading and without going extinct over time. So that was a really cool article. We encourage you, get Creation Magazine. It's really good. It's our favorite magazine that's just all around great for adults and kids and, you know, young adults. It's a
great magazine. When they have a kids section, and it's written in a way, too, where if you're younger, like if you're like in the 14, 15, 16 range, you'll be able to understand what it's saying to you. You don't have to be a super genius scientist to know it and understand what they're saying.
Correct. Hey, Ryan, before I forget, we got to get to our interesting fact of the week. And the interesting fact of the week this week is sponsored by foam-night.com. Again, please go check out their website. They have a lot of really cool stuff, a lot of fun stuff. That's a growing industry, by the way. And it's, you know, it's safe swords and shields and everything. Just check it out, foam-night.com. And we'll also provide a link to their website from our show summary that we always post at rsr.org. So please give that a look. So, Ryan, here is the interesting fact of the week. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, here we go. What modern bird can alter the length of its tools while it works? And why does it matter? I mean, that's kind of a bonus question, but if you can
alter the length of its tools.
Yes.
So a bird that uses tools.
Yep, and it can alter the length.
Is that like a trick question? Is it like a woodpecker where its tool is its, you know, like
no,
that thing?
No, that's...
Okay. That was more of a clarifying question than an answer. Can I phone a friend?
You know, if you could phone a friend, who you'd want to phone is Nicole McBurney. And so this is a perfect question to ask you with Doug on assignment, because he would have secretly... Nicole, what's the answer? Nicole would have known, so she's our bird expert. So anyways.
What bird can lengthen its tools?
Yes.
Bird can, I don't even know a bird that uses tools. Interesting.
Okay.
Is it a penguin? And like it's riding on a, it's, it can lengthen the like length of its, like needs, well, it normally rides in its tummy, but say it wants to use a sled.
Give me a lot of opportunities to hit this thing.
You love that thing, so.
Okay, it's the Goffin's Cockatoo.
Oh, man, it was I was right there.
It adjusts the length of stick tools mid-task to reach food, demonstrating foresight, planning, and engineering skill.
Hmm.
So there you go, Ryan, the cockatoo. So we talked about it earlier in the show. You know, if you'd have thought about, hey, maybe he'll pull in an interesting fact. So again, the interesting fact was sponsored by foam-knight.com. Again, please check out their website. Okay, so Ryan, what's the next story you want to talk about?
So next up, we'll talk about penguin wings inspiring engineering, which is another thing that we kind of talk about a lot. But I always think it's cool when humans will end up mimicking what God did first. And this is how penguin wings, they're pretty aerodynamic for when they swim, especially because, you know, they can't really fly. But when they swim, they're really good for swimming and being aerodynamic. So a German car company called Mahl, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, they use this design for their fans in their car. So it's really interesting because it doesn't really have to do with, you know, moving through water or anything. But because they're just well designed and just a good shape, they use them for their fans in their car, and they can get pretty small too. And it makes the AC more efficient in their cars, which is kind of cool. And this is yet another example of humans reverse engineering what God created first. And what I also find fascinating about this is the car manufacturers from all, they used AI to try to replicate what was going on. So it was kind of like it's like a three-way thing. It's AI, they use AI to kind of replicate what humans have done and see, which then is replicate what God does. So now we're getting like three stems in this thing, which is kind of fascinating itself.
Yeah, it's amazing where AI is going. And we of course, always do a show on AI about every 6 months or so with our AI expert, Daniel Hedrick. And AI, it has its pluses and minuses. I think right now the pluses really outweigh the minuses. And this is just another example of using AI to learn and to, you know, to help engineer something like this.
Now AI itself is now learning that God's creatures have really incredible design and learning how to leverage that.
Yep. Okay. So Ryan, I did not want to forget about the suicide insects. So let's talk about exploding insects. So it's called autophthisis. It's found in ants and termites, and they'll rupture these specialized glands and sacrifice themselves to protect their colony. So, you know, and the kamikazes, that made no sense because they had no chance. And, you know, that was wrong and immoral. I mean, God does not want people to kill themselves. But in nature and in a fallen nature, because of the fallen our fallen nature, you've got things like these exploding insects to protect themselves and to protect their colonies. It's just, and it's a very intricate engineering system just to make this thing happen. And so, Ryan, I guess when you think about this evolving, I mean, how do you evolve that? I guess the thing blows up and somehow the species remembers, oh, maybe that helped us here. So they just have to do a lot of blowing up, kind of like the giraffe's head. The giraffe's head has to keep blowing up every time it gets a drink of water until those valves form, you know.
But they also have to make sure they don't do it at the wrong time. So they don't want to be like, you know, talking to their best friend in the colony, you know, eating whatever they're eating and just blow up spontaneously on accident. Like, oh, dang it, Jim. You know, Jim messed up there and he accidentally exploded. They have like a days without incident tracker, and, you know, they have to reset it to zero because Jim exploded spontaneously because he couldn't control it.
Yep. So again, this is another example of a design mechanism, Ryan, that has to be completely in place. You know, it's like the bombardier beetle. I know that, you know, Doug did a show with Dr. McIntosh on the bombardier beetle and that whole intricate design, where we've got an insect that actually sends out an explosion in its, you know, out of its abdomen as a defense mechanism. And we know that there's evidence that we did have fire-breathing dragons, which were just a type of dinosaur that could store, you know, things in its head. You know, that dinosaur that has that huge beak that goes back. It's not a beak, but the huge...
Yeah.
And that thing, you know, with all the right mechanisms and a trigger to release a spark and methane gas, you can have an explosion. And we see the intricate design of the bombardier beetle. And now we've got insects that will actually blow themselves up to protect their colony. It's pretty wild. Pretty wild nature. Mm-hmm.
I think the article does a good job of explaining all the things it has to have in order to make it be able to happen. It can't just happen one at a time, as they use the term irreducible complexity, because it needs the specialized gland. It needs the trigger mechanism. It needs the delivery pathway. It needs the chemical adhesives or toxins. And obviously, no one only to use it at the right time, which if you're missing one of those, it doesn't work. And it ends in disaster without one of them. Yeah. So.
And you think natural selection is going to kind of somehow prune this over time and every time send its condolences every time it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's pretty silly, Ryan. Okay. And so then, Ryan, another story is that's related to this in a way, in a different way, maybe on the other side of the spectrum, is animals using natural medicines. Did you get a chance to read that story?
Yeah, that one was pretty cool. On kind of the other side, they're saving themselves instead of blowing themselves up. But you've got a lot of different examples, like chimps using anti-parasitic leaves and eating those, parrots consume detoxifying clay.
Parrots eating dirt.
Yeah, literally eating dirt. That's different than the cockatoos drinking water out of a drinking fountain, that's for sure. And then elephants are seeking out medicinal tree bark, which is kind of cool. And then bees bring antimicrobial resins into the hives. Like a lot of different things that are kind of cool. Natural medicine is being used by animals.
Yeah. And again, this is something that evolution cannot explain. This is built in wisdom. It's built in information to be able to do these things. So,
because it's not really a genetic thing. It's not something you can get by mutations learning that. It's just a built in instinct is all it can really be.
Yep. So, you've got parrots consuming dirt. You got cockatoos that can, get drink out of a human drinking thing. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Elephants eating tree bark.
It makes it sound like they seek it out too. Like they're not just gnawing on every tree hoping it works. They kind of know how to seek it out.
They already have the knowledge built in. So, And so, Ryan, one of these days we got to do the reverse engineering, like the top 10. We have all these list shows. We got to get to like the top 10 reverse engineered things that, man looks at to improve designs. Like you mentioned, the penguin and the propeller fan. There's so many more examples. There's so many stories we can't get to in Creation Magazine, but we encourage you to get it. It comes out quarterly. It's a great magazine to share with families, friends. Take it to the doctor's office and leave it for them and for someone else to see it. What a great magazine.
If you're in college, it's great to just leave, like read it, finish it, then leave it on a table in the student center or something.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and by the way, we've got a new store. So our store is now shop.rsr.org. You can get to the store like you always have before by going to rsr.org, and there's a link at the top to get to the store, and even rsr.org/store still works, but we're now going with shop.rsr.org. It's a new store, new format. If you want to sponsor a show, it's a lot easier to go on there. If you want to run ads on our program to help Real Science Radio, to help us, we have a great team of producers. We like to do whatever we can to promote the show and to keep the show going. We have to pay for our airtime on the radio. We're on KLTT, AM 670, every Friday at 12:30 p.m., right at the lunch hour. We're glad to have everybody listening to us on KLTT. We really appreciate their partnership, but we do have to pay for that airtime. So everything you send in helps the show keep going, and we really appreciate that. And again, we thank our sponsor today, foam-night.com. It's a Christian-run business, and we ask you to check out their products. And so, Ryan, it was great to have you back in studio, and someday you'll be the Neanderthal in this show.
Yeah. And until then, looking forward to next time.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So for my co-host today, Ryan Williams, I'm Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.